this today. We are doing zoonoses. What's the definition of zoonoses? Lexi cheated. She read it. Yeah, zoonoses are diseases transmissible naturally from animals to humans. So it's usually an occupational hazard with people that are working around animals, like veterinarians, those that work in slaughterhouses or meat packing companies.
Pig raising.
Pig raising. Yeah. So basically, the difference is there is no human to human transmission, with one exception. But usually it's not human to human. There has to be some animal involved or some vector involved or something of that sort. So humans are what we call a dead end host. Not literally. But once a human is infected, it stops with the human. They don't transmit it to other people. Of course, the vector or the animal can continue to transmit it. Okay, let's begin. And the way we classify these is by their route of transmission, how they are transmitted to humans. So there's different ways of transmitting them, or of classifying them. But that's the means that we're going to use. Okay, so ingestion. This would be ingesting dairy products, meat, something like that, that is infected with the organism. Brucellosis is the first organism we're going to talk about, and there are different species. Brucella melitensis is the main one that we contract from the dairy products or the meat. Brucella abortus is another one, but that's usually not transmitted to humans. It's a gram-negative rod. And I have tried to color code the morphology of the Gram-Stain reaction so that you can better remember it. Some people remember colors. So it's gram-negative rod. And a lot of these we don't encounter in the laboratory. Some of them can grow on laboratory media, but many of them we don't encounter, and many of them we're not going to look for automatically. So the doc has to give us an idea of what he or she is looking for. So there has to be some index of suspicion conveyed to the laboratory before we look for this stuff. Okay, symptoms of brucellosis, acute fever. So this would be one of those fevers of unknown origin, those FUOs that we might encounter. The doc doesn't know initially what's causing it. The patient just has a pretty high fever. It can get into the blood, cause septicemia, and we know all the symptoms that go along with septicemia, such as chills, weakness, fatigue, myalgia, anorexia. We can do blood cultures. So one of the reasons we're talking about this zoonosis this week is because oftentimes we can do blood cultures to identify them. But it's a very slow-growing organism, so we have to keep the culture for up to 3 weeks if this is something that we suspect. Oftentimes, however, it's better to do immunologic identification of these organisms. For two reasons. Number one is because they either don't grow, well, actually three reasons. They may not grow on the laboratory media, they may grow very slowly, or number three, they're too infectious, so we don't want to mess around with them, growing them in the laboratory. So we'll do immunologic. Who remembers what ANC is? I just cannot give away that $100 bill in my pocket. ANC sera. There you go. You're on the right track. Acute and convalescent. Acute and convalescent sera. You remember that? How do we do acute and convalescent sera?
It's got to be around 50 at least.
At least 50? Well, you're getting a free lunch. What more do you want? okay, you don't remember how to do acute convalescent sera.
It's like dilution.
We do serial dilutions. We have to collect the blood in the beginning, the early stages of the disease, and hold it, and then maybe a couple weeks later or longer, because oftentimes some of these are chronic illnesses as well. We collect the blood again, and then we run the immunologic test, and we do serial dilutions. So we're looking for, in this case, a positive reaction clear out to the 1 to the 320 dilution. So that's a pretty positive reaction. But we have to look for at least a fourfold change in dilution. So in the beginning stages, it's going to be very low. We're looking for antibody titer. In the beginning stages, it's going to be very low. If the patient does have the disease, that antibody titer is going to build up over those 2 or 3 week period. And then we draw the blood again. So now, does acute convalescence sound familiar? Everybody say yes.
Yes.
And the purpose of that exactly is, I mean, how is that helpful for the physician or whoever's attending the patient?
Well, in the early stages, with a very low antibody titer, we don't know for sure if that antibody that's there is because they have a current infection. It could have been a previous infection.
But what other symptoms? I mean, what the doc or whoever know?
No, because these diseases, I mean, take a look at those symptoms. There's nothing specific there that tells the doc it's brucellosis. Unless there's a history, with their occupation, for example, if there's a history of working around the animals or something, it would lead the doc to suspect it might be a zoonosis, but not necessarily brucellosis.
Okay, so in other words, it might take them 21 days to diagnose that.
Right. If you grow it, wait for something to grow. Yeah, it's just there's just nothing really specific about the symptoms to indicate it's brucellosis versus one of these other zoonoses, or it doesn't even have to be a zoonosis, another chronic illness with these types of symptoms.
So they really can't even treat the patient for 21
days? Oh, they would probably treat it. These are bacteria, so they can't be treated. So they would probably apply some broad spectrum type antibiotic that might affect a lot of different things.
Could they use like IgG versus IgM antibodies?
If the test is available. In some cases, the test is available. Hepatitis, for example.
Right.
That's a very common one. They can do that. But most of these, because they're so rare, they're not going to have those tests available. It's just not cost effective for the manufacturer to develop those types of tests.
Gotcha, that makes sense.
Okay, now there used to be a panel that we would do, Kyle, called febrile agglutinins. And I don't know that they do febrile agglutinins anymore. But what it was a panel of antigens testing for a variety of organisms. Brucellosis was one of these. I think tularemia was another one. I think salmonella typhoid fever was another one. So it was a panel of antigens that tested for a variety of different antibodies that could cause these types of symptoms, particularly high fevers. That's where the name febrile agglutinins comes from. But it wasn't specific for any one disease state. So now they're trying to get into more specific type tests, and they're not doing the febrile agglutinin panel anymore. Okay, a second way of transmitting is by inhalation, inhaling spores or the organism or whatever it happens to be. First one on the list here is anthrax. Anthrax can actually be transmitted in 3 different ways. So one of them, and the most serious one, is inhalation. This is caused by the organism Bacillus anthracis, which is a gram-positive rod. We often refer to these organisms as boxcar-type organisms because they are these long, broad, rectangular-shaped rods. And they do have spores. So if we do a spore stain, you can see the spores that are in the organism. Okay? These, the organism is associated with not just goats, but other wild animals. And the spores often get into the wool or the hide of the organism. So the person contracting this would be, again, in that kind of occupation, working closely with these animals or animal hides or wool or something. Let's talk about, first of all, cutaneous anthrax. Okay, this is, I put 95% up here because most of the anthrax cases that we see are cutaneous anthrax. So the spores, whether they be in the wool or the hide of the organism, of the animal, whatever, they usually enter through injured skin. So the person working with these will have an abrasion or a cut or something on the skin. The spores get in. The spores can then germinate. We know that the spores are just kind of a dormant form of the organism. They germinate into the organism, reproduce, and cause cutaneous anthrax, which is usually limited to the skin. That's why we call it cutaneous. So it starts out as a papule, develops into a painless ulcer, which then becomes necrotic, and we call it an S jar. And when it heals, it usually leaves a scar. So here's an example of a lot of the erythema. You can see a blister kind of forming right in here. And then as it progresses, it becomes necrotic. That's the eschar. But they describe it as a painless ulcer. So I have no idea why it doesn't cause pain, but apparently very little pain, if any, is involved. And then there's one more picture on the arm there. So that's an eschar. It becomes necrotic, it heals, and leaves a scar. But it usually is not serious or life-threatening at this point. Okay, the second way we can contract anthrax is intestinal. So we can ingest spores with contaminated meat that hasn't been properly processed or cooked. Febrile, again, the patient will develop fever, symptoms that go along with fever, bloody stools, diarrhea. This is very, very uncommon. The intestinal form of anthrax is not common at all. The one that we're most concerned with is the pulmonary form of anthrax. That would be inhaling the spores. This is what's used for biological warfare. It's also known as wool sorter's disease because a lot of people were working with the wool in the hides and they would inhale the spores. Spores then get into macrophages and germinate, and this one is so lethal that death can occur within 24 hours without treatment. Okay, so you all remember a few years ago the anthrax scare where people, somebody, in fact, they finally did find out who it was.
Yeah.
That was sending these powder in the mail, through the mail, sending it to various places. And then what was the treatment? Does anybody remember what the treatment was? And it still is. At that time, it still is. They talked a lot about it on the news. They just called it Cipro. It stands for ciprofloxacin. Is the treatment.
That's the same thing for treating UTIs, isn't it?
Can be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, there's nothing unusual about it or specific for anthrax. It's just a newer third generation type cephalosporin, but it's particularly effective against anthrax. There is a vaccine for anthrax that they have been using mostly on military personnel at this point, so it's not generally available for the public. Okay, continuing with inhalation. Q fever. Anybody heard of Q fever? It's caused by rickettsia. We're going to save this one and come back and talk about it when we get into the rickettsia because there are other diseases caused by rickettsia. Okay. Second means, or third means, I guess, of transmission is animal bite. Most common one, and the one you should think of first, is pasteurilosis, caused by the organism Pasteurella multicida. It's a gram-negative rod. And this one will grow on routine media, so we can culture this in the laboratory. Blood chocolate grows well. But it is isolated from 50% of infections caused by dog or cat bites or even scratches. So that's why you should think of Pasteurella first. Back in December, all the stray cats in the neighborhood end up on my porch. We pulled up in the driveway, and there was this little black fur ball on the front porch. And so my friend went out to get it, and it ran. It was part feral's cat. It was part feral wild. And it got under the porch, and when it came out from the porch, she was bending down trying to get it. It came out, and she grabbed it, and it bit her. And stung out three fingers. Fingers got a good bite, but she held on tight. And we got it in the house. It was just too cold to leave it outside, so we brought it in the house and got it settled. And then I took it to the ER. We went to the ER. I said, Pasteurella. Can't take any chances. So we went to the ER. The doc looked at her, and he said, yeah, we need to be concerned about Pasteurella. So the doc was on the ball. So she was given some antibiotic, and I forgot what he gave her at that time, but nothing ever developed from it, fortunately, because we didn't know, being a feral cat, we didn't know what it would have gotten into.
Is that the same concern they have with like cat scratching babies? Have you ever heard that before? Like
cat scratching what?
Cat scratching a baby, like there's a particular concern there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is not the only one. In fact, we're going to talk about another one. This is not the only one, but because it's isolated from 50% of them, this is the one we think about first. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a bite, it can be a scratch. Because you don't know what their claws have gotten into either.
Is that the cause of cat scratch fever?
No, there's another one. Okay, so what we get from Pastorella cellulitis, you know what that is? It's diffuse erythema, underlying tissues that can spread, or an abscess that develops. But the thing is, if it's not treated, it can spread to an osteomyelitis, which is a bone infection, which is very difficult to treat, and arthritis, so it can cause some more serious problems if it's not dealt with. Rat bite fever, we're not likely to encounter, probably, unless you are working as in the laboratory with rats, taking care of rats in cages, or a researcher working with rats somehow. But these organisms, Miter, and particularly Streptobacillus vanilliformis is a gram-negative rod, these are on the flora of the nasopharynx and the urine of rats. So it's not unusual to encounter this working with those types of animals. It's mostly just a cutaneous rash, ulcerated. In some cases, it could be more severe, but usually it's not that severe. Okay, here's another one. Excuse me, choking here. Capnocytophagic canamorphosis. Let me pass this around. He's smiling today. This is a case study, and I don't even remember where I got it from. But you can read it later. It's just kind of interesting. It's about a clinical laboratory scientist, very astute microbiologist, that helped isolate this organism and helped the doc to determine exactly what the infection was. So it's just kind of interesting, some of the things that you can do as you're working, but it also shows how important these guys are, because the docs don't know a lot of this stuff. I had a student tell me not long ago that a doc called the lab and wanted to know what enterococcus was. They didn't know what enterococcus was, so they don't get a whole lot of training. Did anybody get one? Did I hand that out? Okay. They don't often know what this stuff is, so you guys are very... helpful, can be. Okay, this one was originally called DF2, which stands for dysglottic fermenter. They put it in that category because they didn't know where it belonged until they did further studies and put it in this genus and species, so it's now called Capnocytophaga canamorphosis. That's an easy way to pronounce. Use that in your conversations. And it often comes from dog bites, so here's another dog bite. It's mild, localized infection. Usually it can become septicemic if the patient, if it gets into the blood. So another reason why you don't want to leave these animal bites and things undiagnosed or untreated. When I was probably 9 or 10, I don't remember, I was at my aunt's house, and they had a dog. Was outside, and for some reason the dog just started running across the yard and attacked me. Jumped up and it bit me in the face. And I had some pretty bad, if I still got one little scar here from one of these tooth marks. But it just, I just had these massive bite and scratch marks in my face. So, had to go to the doc, and I don't know what the dog gave me, of course, but treated me with something. I had to keep it dry. And my friends went swimming, and I was so angry because I couldn't go swimming. But it swelled. It was swollen. Is what I was going to say. Anyway, we got it treated. But I still like dogs. I'm still really a dog person, masquerading as a cat person. Okay, let's go into arthropod vectors. What are some types of arthropods? Ticks, flies, fleas, lice, those kinds of things. Okay, so they become infected, then they bite us, and during the bite, they either transmit the organism through their saliva or they defecate and it gets into our skin that way. One of these is Lyme disease. Anybody know about Lyme disease? Why is it called Lyme disease? I color-coded this, too.
Isn't there a town or a village called Lyme? That's where they first
Lyme, Connecticut. Yeah, Lyme, Connecticut. Anybody back east there? That's where it started, or where it was first diagnosed, back in 1975, I believe it was. And it took them a couple of years to identify the organism. But the organism is now known as Borrelia burgdorferi. Borrelia are spirochetes. It's called burgdorferi because the researcher who finally identified it, his name was Willy Burgdorfer. And so he got to name it after himself, so it came burgdorferi. Spirochete is transmitted by ticks, and the ticks feed on mice, usually mice initially, and then deer, and infect them, or if they are already infected, then when the tick takes the blood meal from them, the tick becomes infected, and then the tick lands on us and gets bitten. Let's go through the life cycle. We don't have to memorize this, but just to kind of show you, it's kind of interesting. Anybody here ever been had tick bites or ticks on them? Where were you? Florida. Okay. Anybody? Yeah, Emily.
New Jersey.
New Jersey, back there. So you've heard of Lyme disease back in that area. So it started back in that area, but it spread westward. So pretty much every state can now have Lyme disease. So this one starts out as a little eggs. It hatches from the eggs as a larva. And then the larva, the first summer, because it's so tiny, it just jumps on a mouse. And the mouse is probably infected. And so as it takes its blood meal, the tick becomes infected. And then through the fall and winter, it goes dormant. And then the next spring, it hatches into an eight-legged nymph. So there's the nymph form, which is slightly bigger than the larvae. And now the human gets involved, or dogs or whatever. If we're out hiking or walking in the wooded areas where the ticks are, then the tick can jump on the human, take another blood meal, develops into the adults, so we have male and females. They then attach to deer that are populating the area, mate on the deer, and then the female lays her eggs, the male dies. And that's the life cycle, so it starts all over again. So we just happen to get in the middle of this life cycle. But this is what the nymph or the tiny thing looks like. On the skin, this is on the skin, this is the head of a pin. So it's so tiny, it just looks like a speck of dirt or whatever. You wouldn't know that it was a tick, really, unless you're really looking for this kind of stuff. These are the adult ones. Don't they just... Dude, I just hate leg things. The one consoling feature, I guess, is they're not really that big. Okay. I was back in Missouri a few years ago. I was helping some friends back there move this lady. She lived kind of in a wooded area, and she was moving. She was an elderly lady. She lived in a trailer. She was moving, I think, to Florida to live with another daughter. But one of the reasons she was moving is because she lived alone. She said, I don't have anybody to check my back for ticks. Because there were ticks in that area. And I remember after we'd moved her and we were in the car going back, I saw ticks on my jeans. They're not me, but they're on my jeans. It's just little tiny black things. And I was just spooked. I just freaked out. I can't handle those. Anything with legs, more than two legs, can't handle it. Okay, so symptoms of Lyme disease. Initially, probably through the first month or so, just flu-like symptoms. So again, here's something else with the same type, non-specific symptoms. Don't really know what it is. The clinical history is very important. If there's a history of a tick bite, then that will lead the doc down this certain path to diagnosis. The other thing that's helpful in diagnosis is the rash. There is a cutaneous rash that develops. The rash is called erythema chronica migrans. And when if that rash is present, then it's much easier to diagnose the disease. But the problem is the rash is only present in about 50% of the patients. So if they don't have a history of tick bites, then it's really difficult to diagnose. I have a neighbor who, when she was a teenager, I guess, they lived in Provo, I guess up in the hills a little bit. She actually had Lyme disease. And I don't know the whole story. I don't know how they were actually able to diagnose it. But here's more. So And the organism kind of migrates in these concentric circles and spreads to different body parts. This is the same person. Here's a different one. Sometimes you get this concentric bullseye-type rash from it. So if the rash is present, symptoms there. Otherwise, it's just like flu-like symptoms. And it can be respond to a variety of things. Okay, if it's diagnosed at this point, then it can be treated quite easily with tetracycline, which is usually the drug of choice, but other medications can treat it as well. If it is not diagnosed, it can progress into neurologic symptoms. Within a couple of months or so, it can progress. It can range anywhere. Sometimes it's confused with multiple sclerosis. Sometimes it's confused with dementia. It can be that severe. That's probably uncommon. But just a lot of neurological signs or symptoms. And then it can develop into chronic arthritis. It can get into the joints. And once it gets to that point, then it's very difficult to treat. And patients will need to be treated with intravenous antibiotics for a period of time, for a long period of time. If not, then it becomes chronic and they suffer with arthritis, severe arthritis, for the rest of their lives. So this, again, is something you want to diagnose early. Diagnosis is mostly serological. So we do have antigen antibody tests that we can detect the organism, because being a spirochete, this is not one that grows on routine media, so we can't culture the organism in the laboratory. Okay, let's go on to more arthropod vectors. Plague. Yersinia pestis. Okay, gram-negative rod. We know about Yersinia, gram-negative rod. It's usually found in rats and rodents, and it's transmitted by the bite of a flea. So a flea would bite the infected rat. The flea picks up the organism and then bites the human. So again, the arthropod vector transmitted that way. Of course, we know there's been epidemics of plague throughout the centuries. It was first determined what caused it. It was in Hong Kong, where a researcher, his name was Alexander Ersin. That's where it gets this name of Yersinia. Alexander Ersin just by observation pretty much noticed the association between dead rats living in, or not living, but found in homes and people having the symptoms of plague. He noticed fleas associated with the rats. He just kind of put everything together, did some dissection studies, found these organisms in the humans and in the fleas and the rats. And so anyway, that's how it was all put together. This is back in the 1880s, I think. Okay, two forms of plague. One is bubonic and one is pneumonic. Okay, bubonic plague is probably the most common form that we see. What are buboes? Usually in the lymph nodes, very swollen lymph nodes. Okay, let's go through the transmission here. Again, you don't have to memorize this whole thing, but there's two ways it can be transmitted. One is from wild animals, rodents, carnivores, whatever. The flea bites them, gets infected, and then bites the human and transmits it. So the buboes are the swollen lymph nodes, usually in the inguinal area, which is around the groin. They can occur up in the cervical area, in the neck area, where we get enlarged lymph nodes. It can also come from domesticated animals. There was a case not too long ago in Utah Valley where a young girl, contracted the plague from her cat. The cat had been out roaming around and had encountered, so they think, a squirrel or something like that that was infected with the plague and transmitted either by catching the squirrel and eating part of it, or again transmitted by fleas or whatever. But the cat died. Sad story. The cat died, but the girl didn't. So happy overall, happy ending. But it was plague right here in beautiful downtown Utah Valley. Okay, so associated with the buboes are fever and subcutaneous hemorrhage. So here's a bubo. See the swollen lymph node. Now this always looks like an arm to me, but apparently it's a leg. It looks like a leg. It must be a leg. This is up in the towards the groin area. The buboes can sometimes leak separation. So you get fluid draining from the buboes. And it can lead to gangrene. And the virulence factors of the organism, Yersinia pestis. It's encapsulated, for one. But it produces this toxin, this exotoxin. It's a we'll call it a necrotizing exotoxin because it leads to things like this. Excessive bleeding and then eventually the gangrene necrosis of the tissues. Okay, so the other form of plague is pneumonic plague, which is a very severe pneumonia. And this is the exception to the rule of zoonosis that we talked about. This can be transmitted person to person. So if the organism, if it starts out, it doesn't always have to start out as bubonic plague, but it can start out as bubonic plague. It can get into the blood. It can travel to the lungs, causing the severe pneumonia, pneumonic plague. The patient coughs, exhales the organism in the air. Another person breathes in the organism. So that's how it's transmitted person to person. Or it doesn't have to start out as bubonic. It can simply start out as pneumonic. Just inhale, the organism gets into the lungs. This one is very, very lethal. The patient can die within 12 to 24 hours if it's not treated. So it has a high, very high mortality rate.
Is there a septicemic plague as well? It seems like I've never heard about third varieties.
Well, it would be septicemic if from buboes, from the bubonic plague, it gets into the blood and spreads the lungs that way. So there would be some septicemic as well.
How did the girl get it from her cat?
Probably fleas, I would imagine. So the cat probably either consumed or ate part of the squirrel, or fleas from the squirrel jumped to the cat. And then the cat brought home the fleas, and the fleas got on the girl and bit her. At least that's... Well, I think they did find fleas on the cat. But they don't... They assume it came from the squirrel, but I don't know.
The pneumonic version from animal to person? Like if the cat had it, and it's lost, and the girl grew up close like that?
I suppose it's possible. But I don't really know of any cases like that. So I think it would be very rare if it was. Okay, another one is relapsing fever caused by Borrelia recurrentis. Borrelia, again, is a spirochete, so it's another species of Borrelia recurrentis. This can come in two forms, epidemic or endemic form, depending upon what the vector is. So if it's a louse, it causes an epidemic form. If it's a tick, it's an endemic form. We call it relapsing fever because it starts out with a very, very high fever, up to 106 degrees, which is very high, for approximately a week. You know, it varies a little bit. Associated with that would be the chills and the pain and the myalgia. So those are all septicemic type symptoms. And then they go into an afebrile phase for another week or a few days, so they don't have any symptoms. And then they relapse, comes back, the fever comes back. And so they can go through 3 to 6 cycles of this. Each cycle is progressively less severe than the original one, and eventually it will die out. That's the characteristic of relapsing fever. Okay, then there's tularemia. Tularemia is another one that was included in that febrile agglutinin panel that I talked about, where the patient just has fever and these symptoms, and they don't know what it is, so they do these non-specific antibodies, trying to antigen test it, trying to find out what the antibody is. Caused by Francisella tularensis, another gram-negative rod. This one, I've emphasized down here, is too infectious to culture. So I really don't want to mess around with that. If you are working in a laboratory culturing these things, you want to make sure you're working under safety hood, taking as many precautions as possible. This one is often associated with rabbits. That's how I always think about it. When I think about rabbits, I think about tularemia. That's why I've never had a pet rabbit. But it's not just rabbits. It can be other wild or domestic animals transmitted by ticks, biting flies, which we often call deer flies. They're pretty big flies. Symptoms, acute febrile granulomatous disease is just the development of nodules in the tissues, inflammatory nodules, along with flu-like symptoms. So again, very nonspecific initially. We usually diagnose it serologically. Here's a case back in 2004 in American Fork. An 8-year-old American Fort boy has contracted an uncommon bacterial infection called tularemia. The news of Benjamin Sumption's illness came the same day that a Utah County woman was confirmed as the fourth case of West Nile virus in Utah. So this was back, what, six years ago almost, when that West Nile was really big, just coming into this area. While both diseases can be transmitted by tiny insects, the illnesses are very different. It's a bacterial infection rather than a virus like West Nile. It's not from mosquitoes. It's from fleas or deer flies. It can be spread by infected insects or by handling an infected animal carcass or from drinking contaminated water. The boy likely got tularemia from a deer tick bite while camping in Moab, which I've done before. Probably many of you have done too. After returning, the boy noticed a mark on his arm. He developed a fever and swollen lymph nodes under his arm. He has been treated with antibiotics and hasn't been hospitalized. It's a bite that just behaves unusually. If it goes untreated, it can lead to a very serious, life-threatening form of pneumonia. It's not a lot unlike anthrax or the plague. Though only 200 cases of tularemia are reported each year in the U.S., 8 cases have been reported in Utah since 2001, so approximately 1 year. 6 of those were in Utah County. Tularemia symptoms include sudden fever, chills, headaches, diarrhea, muscle aches, joint pain, dry cough, progressive weakness. So again, all non-specific symptoms that initially could point to a lot of things. People can protect themselves by using insect repellent containing DEET. So just remember that when you go out. And that's a typical type of the ulceration that develops with tularemia. Okay, continuing on to rickettsia. Okay, this is the family of rickettsia. There are these genera: rickettsia, coxiella, rockalomea, and ehrlichia. These are intracellular pathogens, which differentiates them from other bacteria. They are bacteria, they can be treated with antibiotics, but they are intracellular pathogens. Okay, let's go through the rickettsia. Most common one is Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. I'm sure you've all heard that. It's caused by the organism Rickettsia rickettsii, which is germinated rods, and is transmitted by a tick, a particular tick, Dermacentor. And there's the the villain in the plot. Okay. Usually get these spots. That's why it's called Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. Fever associated with it, but the spots, and these are not just typical rashes. These are
hemorrhages.
Yes. These are hemorrhages. So the organism gets into the endothelial cells, which are the cells lining the capillaries and the blood vessels, and causes bleeding. There's more. A little bit more severe, and here's a very severe form. So the bleeding can develop from petechiae into ecchymoses in very severe cases. However, it is easily treated with antibiotics, and when it is treated, the mortality rate is low, maybe less than 10% mortality rate, probably about 20% if it's not treated. But being bacteria, can be easily treated. But you can see how difficult these things are to diagnose. So patient history is very important. Another one called rickettsial pox is another spotted fever, but it is not as severe as Rocky Mountain spotted fever in terms of its symptoms. This is caused by a mouse mite. And again, we end up with an S jar and fever for 1 to 2 weeks. There's the type of S jar that develops with rickettsial pox. That's why it's called rickettsial pox, is because you get these pox, things like chicken pox, smallpox. The typhus group, and these are categorized according to the types of symptoms that occur. So in the typhus group, there's endemic typhus, which is caused by Rickettsia typhi, transmitted by a rat flea, Xenopsyla is the genus of the rat flea, febrile, transient rash. These are interesting diseases. Let's go to the next one, which is epidemic louse-borne typhus caused by Rickettsia promozygia. This one was quite prevalent during World War II, particularly in the concentration camps, because the people were living under such horrible conditions of starvation, work, the excessive work that they had to do. They didn't have nutrition. They didn't have any medication, whatever. Lice were very predominant throughout these barracks, and the people would contract hankus. And in addition to everything else they suffered, they had diseases like this one. Severe, very, very severe headache, fever, chills. They didn't often die from it. Some people did, but they were just extremely sick, and sometimes they would be forced to go out and work still with this type of disease. Recrudescent typhus, also known as Brill-Zinsser disease, occurs the same organism after a person has had epidemic typhus. In some people, the organism goes dormant for a while. It doesn't disappear, it just becomes dormant, and then something reactivates it, who knows what. And they come up with another case of epidemic typhus, but fortunately it's milder than the first type. Scrub typhus, this used to be a rickettsia, Rickettsia sinusi. Aren't these fun? It's now put in a different genus known as Orientia. Instead of rickettsia, it's Orientia sinusi. Mite or a chigger, but again, same type symptoms. They don't have the spots, the rashes, like the spotted fever group. Trench fever caused by rock alamea, Quintana. Okay, this one can be cultured. This is the one of the family, rickettsia, that can be cultured on routine or media. It might require some special media, but it can be cultured, whereas the others can't. Body louse, classical rickettsial symptoms, and again, a disease of crowding and poor sanitation. So this was another time that the concentration camp victims suffered, but also the soldiers in the war suffered this. So not only did they have to deal with everything else in the war, but this was easily spread because it is the body louse, easily spread from person to person, and a lot of them were suffering with trench fever. That's probably what gets its name, because they were in the trenches. Q fever. Okay, we mentioned Q fever, said it was caused or transmitted by inhalation aerosols. The organism is Coxiella burnettii, which is in the family Rickettsia. So it is a similar type organism, but it is transmitted by an arthropod ticks with flu-like symptoms. Okay, now did you talk about Ehrlichia when you were in hematology?
Yes.
Okay, so you all know this one, Ehrlichiosis. Organism Ehrlichia canis, Chaffeensis, gram-negative cocci, tick bite. These multiply in phagosomes of host leukocytes, so it's often referred to as human granulocytic Ehrlichiosis. So it's different from rickettsia because it does not multiply in the endothelial cells. It doesn't cause the hemorrhaging or the bleeding. But symptoms resemble Rocky Mountain spotted fever, at least 20% of them have rashes. Here's a Wright's stain. So these cocci are appearing dark purple, but that's a Wright's stain, not a Gram stain. I went to a seminar once up in Jackson, Wyoming, about microbiology, and one of the doctors that was presenting, his son had a case of Ehrlichiosis, and it took them a while to diagnose it, because they really had no clue, just these non-specific symptoms, but they finally did diagnose it. Okay, one thing you need to know, even though we don't do it so much anymore, is the Weill-Felix agglutination test. And one of the reasons this is important is because it uses strains of Proteus mirabilis and Proteus vulgaris, to help identify a lot of these diseases. So what they do is they take antigens. These are antigens, OX19, OX2, OXK, different antigens from both Proteus mirabilis and vulgaris. And for some reason, there is cross-reactivity between these organisms and the antigens of these Proteus strains. So, for example, look at Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It would react with both the antigen OX19 and OX2. These don't down here. These are variable, however. So it's a very non-specific type of test, but it kind of gives a clue as to some of the diseases, rickettsial diseases, perhaps, that you might be dealing with. So that's what they used to use. And I don't suppose in some cases it really matters extremely what specific disease it is, because they're probably treated with good antibiotics. There is a latex agglutination test now for some of these, probably Rocky Mountain spotted fever. I don't imagine it's available for all of them. the reference test is microimmunofluorescence test. And you can do either a single titer that's greater than 164 or acute convalescent serum. Again, because these are oftentimes chronic diseases, so it's just an application of acute and chronic. Two more, I think, erysipelas caused by erysipelatrix rhizopathiae. A positive rod, this forms this type of a lesion. So it's an edematous lesion. Rather than an eschar or an ulcer, it's swelling. And usually people that, again, work in these industries are handling the pigs or the chickens or the fish or whatever, and they have an abrasion and something gets in there. So this is direct skin penetration. And then the last one is leptospirosis, often known as Weil's disease. Another spirochete, Leptospira, transmitted, it's found in animal urine, rodents. Do you remember a few years ago before West Nile, we had hantavirus?
Yeah.
You remember hantavirus? And they finally associated that with mice and urine from the mice and stuff. Well, same type thing. Flu-like symptoms, but this one causes jaundice. So what does that tell you if it causes jaundice? What else is involved? The liver, right. So this one can go to the liver and affect the liver. So that's the difference with this one. Okay. The end.
Like this.